Ave listeners, a quick notice before we start today's podcast. What you're about to hear is an introduction to Ovid's Fasti. It functions as the first episode to our new podcast mini-series, which is funding on Kickstarter. If you are one of the treasured and appreciated backers, you'll receive six additional episodes exploring Ovid's Fasti with Rhiannon Evans and Peter Davis. The campaign goes for another 18 days, and I think we're about 11 backers away from reaching the funding goal. So if you'd like to help out and hear the rest of the mini-series, go to kickstarter.com and search for Ovid's Fasti, or you'll find a link in the show notes and on our relevant social media channels. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today are two guests, Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University, and Dr. Peter Davis, Visiting Research Fellow in Classics at the University of Adelaide. This is Episode CLI, Ovid's Fasti. The Fasti is a poem about the Roman calendar, written by the poet Ovid during the reign of the Emperor Augustus. Writing the poem gave Ovid the chance to think about contemporary Rome through the medium of some of the best-known Roman stories, like the city's foundation by Romulus and Remus, and the creation of the Republic by Brutus. Here's Rhiannon Evans and Peter Davis.
So Ovid was the most important poet in the second half of the reign of Augustus. He was born in March 43 BCE. He went on to write what we can divide his career into three phases. There's love poetry to start with. So we have the Amores, which is a traditional kind of love elegy. Heroides, much more radical, women abandoned by their lovers, writing to the men who abandoned them. Then we have the middle works, the narrative works like Fasti and Metamorphoses. Mm. And then there are the exile works, which are clearly written in exile. It's actually a little bit more complicated than that because Fasti is certainly a narrative work and was written in the middle period, but was clearly revised in exile. And it also seems that the double heroides, the letters between where the men and women write to each other, seems to have been written in exile as well. He died in either 17 or 18 in exile.
Mm. And just kind of briefly, we don't know completely why he was exiled. He referenced it, but
he tells us that he was exiled because of a poem and a mistake. Mm. And the poem was The Art of Love, and he will not say what the mistake was.
Perhaps writing The Art of Love.
I think that was a mistake.
Same thing.
I think that was a mistake. Yes, I agree with that. Yes.
And he was quite close to the imperial family in his own way.
He does seem to have been quite close to the imperial family. So he certainly talks about riding in the parade of knights. I'm talking about the letter he writes to Augustus. He does seem to be somewhat affiliated with the Julian side of the Julio-Claudian family.
Mm.
Familiar with people like the various Julias.
Which might have been the mistake in itself.
That might have been a mistake too.
Being familiar with the Julias who were also exiled. Well,
yes, some have said that he was too familiar with them.
The work that people are going to be most familiar with, I imagine, is the Metamorphoses, and the Fasti is being written at about the same time, so it's an interesting parallel for us.
Absolutely.
To look at.
Metamorphoses is the work that he considers his greatest work, and I think probably rightly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's enormously influential. It's also a wonderful read. It's a fantastic work to read. He's an extraordinarily productive. I mean, he's writing Metamorphoses and he's writing Fasti at the same time.
Mm.
And Metamorphoses is long. It's 15 books long.
15 books. And this, well, how long this is kind of contentious.
This is between 6 and 12.
Between 6 and 12.
So that's only because we have six. They concentrate on a month each.
Yes, correct.
In the format, and so we assume there would have been 12.
Well, no, we don't just assume it. He says in Tristia 2, which is a poem written in 9 CE, that he has written 12.
Just lost the rest of it.
I've got my doubts. I think he's a bit like a lot of academics and students. he claims to have written more than he actually has.
Right, okay.
So we should probably backtrack slightly and say that the Fasti, it's the Latin for the calendar, approximately.
It is Latin for the calendar. Mm.
So it's a work called The Calendar, which might not sound fabulously interesting, but it is because it's based basically around festivals that happen on particular days, although he will go off tangentially from that if he wants to. But that is how he structures the work. So the structure of the work, and as he says, he has done it, although Peter perhaps doesn't believe it, is that there will be 12 books because there is a book a month. You could have various theories, presumably that he suppressed the other six if he did write them.
Yeah.
They were lost somehow.
Well, if you think about his position stuck up there on the Black Sea, he might have found writing July and August a bit tricky.
Mm-hmm.
July is the name for Julius Caesar and August is named for Augustus, and they're particularly significant months in terms of the politics.
And so he does actually mention that in book six, I believe.
He does. He says we're coming up to the Julian calends, so i.e. the 1st of July.
He seems to be building up to writing about July, which is definitely going to involve mentioning Julius Caesar. And by implication, going to August and having to talk about Augustus, who is certainly not absent from what we have in the Fasti. I mean, it's quite viable that he stopped strategically because maybe talking about them would have been more dangerous.
Right, or maybe he just a bit bitter about being exiled.
What do you think, Peter? You know more about the exile poetry than I do. Do you think that potentially he would have seen it as a dangerous thing to do to carry on with this work? Because he does talk about the Julian family. He talks about the princeps, the emperors, in his exile poetry. So maybe I'm inventing a reason that isn't viable.
No, I think you're right. I mean, people, of course, dispute the nature of the exile poetry, but I certainly see irony and difficulty there. But I think it's present in the poem, in this poem, that there's a lot of concern with freedom of speech. There's a lot of anxiety expressed about what you can say and what you cannot say. This is the first poem in which he says he needs the protection of a patron.
Yeah,
he hasn't had that before.
He's been independently wealthy. Unlike
Absolutely.
Other poets, he hasn't needed
he
that.
He is independently wealthy.
Are you implying Germanicus in that by
Absolutely.
The dedication?
Yes, I certainly mean Germanicus.
Can you take us through the dedication? What's the significance of dedicating it to Germanicus? And why would he need that protection?
I suspect that the dedication to Germanicus was written in exile, possibly after 14. I don't have firm views on that. That is after the death of Augustus.
Mm.
Germanicus is associated with the Julian side of the family.
He was the heir.
He's been adopted by Tiberius.
So he's Tiberius' nephew, technically.
He's
adopted as
But the Romans are heavily into adoption, so he thinks of himself as Tiberius' son.
Mm.
But the other aspect of Germanicus is that Germanicus translated Aratus' poem on astronomy, which is a didactic poem, and there are certainly astronomical aspects in Fasti. And so Germanicus could be seen as appropriate in that way too.
So he's seen as a sort of fellow spirit, possibly.
Correct, yes, that's right. We actually have that,
The
translation of Aratus.
Oh, do we? Did not know that.
I don't claim I've read it, but we do.
It's
we
not
have
often
it.
Read.
We do have it.
Mm. So let's talk about the Fasti a bit more then. What style does it have as a poem?
Well, like all the works of Ovid that we have, apart from Metamorphoses, it's written in elegiac couplets.
Mm.
So that means that a couplet consists of a line in 6 feet, a hexameter, and a line in 5 feet, a pentameter. And these very much tend to be self-contained units. The language is fairly simple.
I don't know if you would call this part of the style, but it's often quite elusive in that you need to supply some of the information. So while the writing and maybe the vocabulary might be quite simple, it's not that the whole story is always filled in.
Mm.
It's directed at a Roman reader who would be able to fill in other aspects.
Absolutely.
Probably.
A very good example of that is the story of Lucretia, which is probably the big episode in book two. And there are a number of introductory episodes which are really quite hard to follow unless you've read the relevant bits of Livy.
And then
they become, I think, absolutely clear as to what is going on.
And I think that that's a good reason for producing a podcast series on the Fasti, in that not only is the Metamorphoses longer, although it's still immensely interesting and enjoyable to read, but I think it is a bit easier to read the Metamorphoses without any guidance. Whereas with the Fasti, you kind of need the notes at the back of the book.
Mm.
And I think that some of what we're going to do in the podcast series will also help people to enjoy it.
I hope that's right. I think that's true.
So you referenced Livy then. Would Ovid have been writing with Livy at his side, not, you know, with a copy of Livy's work at his side?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, we're talking about the very early books of Livy, because Ovid in Fasti is actually focused on two periods. He's focused on the earliest parts of Roman history, so especially before the fall of the monarchy, so before 510, so between the foundation and, well, actually before the foundation, but at the earliest period, but then the contemporary period. And he doesn't actually have a lot to say about most of the Republic.
That's a good point, yes. And so he's reflecting, and I suppose we're quite lucky in a way that that's one of the bits of Livy that we have, so
yes,
the early part.
We don't have the Augustan part, and we do know that Livy was writing that, certainly in the late 30s or early 20s, he's writing those books that we're talking about.
Mm.
So they are readily available. And I have no doubt that he's got his scrolls of Livy by his side.
Yeah.
Virgil also is also important too. And he has lots of fun with Virgil.
Who else may have been inspiration for him or predated him when looking at the calendar like this? You mentioned Germanicus before.
I think a really important person is the Greek poet Callimachus, writing in the 3rd century. He writes a poem, again in elegiac couplets. Again, it's a didactic poem. And it's called in Greek, Aitia, which means causes or reasons. And the beginning of its poem is tempora cum causis, which means times together with reasons or causes.
Yeah, that word causa comes up a lot in this poem. So on the face of it, he's explaining the origins of these festivals.
That's exactly right, yes. It's following along the lines of Callimachus.
But you know, the other important source for Ovid is Ovid. His own work gets sometimes reworked in this work.
This is true.
Because he often refers to himself.
He would
get his reference count up.
I've been by
mentioning himself if he were a contemporary academic.
His impact is really great. His impact on himself. Yes, so that when Dido dies, there's an epitaph given, but it's the epitaph that he gave her back when he wrote Dido's letter to Aeneas.
Self-plagiarism.
Actually, that's very bad.
It is these days. It's clearly deliberate. And
of course it is.
Not only is it a, hey, go read my Heroides too, but also it's asking you to place Dido in that literary tradition. The two things I think are really important about a work like this are, and you could say it about so many Roman works, I guess, but maybe more of Ovid than anyone else, that he's very self-consciously literary. So all of those, not exactly sources, but literary influences that feed in are quite clearly laid out, at least the ones that we know about.
Yeah.
And even though it's about the calendar and you get bits of the fasti, certainly very select bits of the fasti are sometimes set for school students to translate because it's got descriptions of mythological stories and those kinds of things. It is intensely political and not just when he's referring directly to contemporary political figures, which again, you could say is true of all Roman poetry. I don't think there is any Roman literature that isn't political, but I think it's quite pointed in the fasti.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the calendar as a subject can sound pretty boring. But if you think about what we do in Australia with public holidays that we have, they actually say something quite a lot about the sort of country that we think of ourselves as being. So if we move on quickly from New Year's Day, you might think about Australia Day as the first major holiday.
It's very contentious at the moment.
Yes, that's right, it is. And Australia Day was chosen to mark British settlement. It's interesting to note that India has the same, exactly the same day, and they mark Republic Day, which is the day they got rid of the British. So in Australia, we mark their arrival. Celebrate is right in some contexts, but it's also known as Invasion Day, and so it's a very contentious day.
Yeah, so which days you choose to celebrate and who you choose to commemorate is
absolutely
really
it's
significant.
Really significant.
For
so
your
you think
own
about
identity.
Anzac Day, which is thought of as the day that when Australia somehow became a nation. It doesn't make much sense to me, but that's how it's spoken of. And here in Melbourne, you celebrate
Melbourne Cup Day.
Melbourne Cup Day and the day before the AFL final.
That's just an excuse for a public holiday. Sorry, both of them are. Both of them are, honestly.
Yeah, so we have them based around sporting events.
It says something about how Australians think of themselves. We still have the Queen's Birthday, which says something about how Australians used to think about themselves.
So Rome was just much the same?
Absolutely. But what I think is really interesting is that after Julius Caesar introduced the new calendar, which is basically the one we still use, 20 new festivals were introduced to mark the Julian family. Events like the wedding anniversary of Augustus and Livia were recorded in the calendar.
Sure.
Can you imagine what you'd think if somehow we started celebrating the Prime Minister's wedding anniversary? You'd think, this country has really changed.
It's a bit different to the emperor. But
also, you mentioned there that Julius Caesar had recently changed the calendar, which shows you how political it is. Not only that these new festivals had been inserted, but that one politician can come along and take control of time, which was a bit out of control, it's true. And I refer people back to our episode on the calendar in Emperors of Rome.
That's right. Go listen to that. And then the calendar gets out of control again because the Romans are not terribly good at counting. And when Augustus becomes Pontifex Maximus, it's brought back under control.
So just to bring it back to the Fasti, that makes this a good poem for Ovid to write because it's such an because the calendar is such an important achievement of the Julian family.
I think that's right. And it's worth noting that he does say in the opening of the poem that one of his goals is to praise the family, to praise Caesar and his kin.
So I wanted you both in this episode to choose a passage or a quotation or a part of the Fasti that you think is good to give people a sense of what is in the Fasti and just to talk us through it a bit. Who wants to go first?
I'm quite happy to go first. I mean, if I am forced to choose two lines, I think I would choose part of the entry for the Ides of March, best known date in all of Roman history. At the very end of the episode, having told this wonderful story about Anna from Virgil's Aeneid, he says, "I was passing by the sword stuck in the princeps. I wasn't going to say anything about the death of Julius Caesar." When Vesta addressed me from her chaste hearth, and so Vesta tells him that he really should say something about Julius Caesar.
So he says something without saying something.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reader is, you see, 15th of March. We all know what this is going to be.
They're reading
and then
it,
he
anticipating
starts telling
it,
about the aftermath of Aeneid Book 4, how Anna runs away from Africa, about the home life of Aeneas and Lavinia, which is not very satisfactory.
We'd never have guessed that from the Aeneid.
How Anna jumps out of the window.
So now if we were doing it, we'd refer to the Ides of March as the elephant in the room that isn't addressed.
Yes,
if he was,
until he's forced to address it.
Until he's forced
That's
to address
right.
it.
That is exactly right, yes.
Rhiannon?
I'm going to choose something from Book 3 as well. The very beginning of the March book is War-Hungry Mars. All right, so that's appropriate. It's Mars, he's the god of war, and this is March. Mm. And straight away he says, "Drop your shield and spear." So forget about war. You're the god of war, but I don't want you to do that. And then, "Be present, loose lustrous hair from that helmet." And he immediately starts to talk about Minerva, who of course is a warrior goddess, but is also a goddess of the arts. Can you imagine trying to bring Mars over to be an arty god? Just seems highly comic. And then he's using that as a lead in to the story of where Romulus and Remus come from, which of course is going to begin with Mars raping Rhea Silvia. So it's sort of not much of a celebration of Mars as what he's famous for, as the war god. And the story of Romulus and Remus and the way that he tells it is also fascinating.
It is, it's terrific.
Particularly the conception, which, as we'll see, Rhea Silvia doesn't remember anything about.
It's truly weird.
It's a very, very strange telling of that narrative. So this is the beginning of a narrative that's quite contentious for the Romans anyway, because, as we know, Remus is going to be written out of the story fairly quickly. So there's another awkward thing the Romans have to deal with. So I'm always interested in how ancient narratives deal with that. Mm. The fratricide, which lies at the basis of Roman foundation. And Ovid has his own particular take on it, which when we get to discuss Book 4, it's got some very interesting aspects. So I really like not only this one, because it is dotted around the poem, actually.
That's right.
Romulus's
That's really one
story.
Significant aspect of it.
Yeah,
it's
not
all broken
told.
Up. There's no unified narrative.
But the way Ovid chooses to deal with these bits of Romulus's story along the way are all interesting. And again, as you mentioned before, Matt, they would undoubtedly be set up against sources like Livy's. So people would be thinking, well, Livy, the historian who's written a few decades earlier, the kind of the standard national story now, what's Ovid doing with that? How is he treating that differently? Is he trying to brush things aside? Is he exposing something about this myth which is uncomfortable for us? Mm-hmm. Or is he giving us something different from the canonical version? So I'm really interested in what he does with Mars and Romulus.
And just quickly, how was the Fasti received? This isn't the poem that he was exiled for, but do we know anything about how it was received during its time?
I don't think we know a lot about how it was received. We do know that certain episodes in it have become very, very important culturally. Mm. I'm thinking in particular of the story of the rape of Lucretia at the end of book two. Shakespeare gets involved there.
Yes.
There are major paintings.
There are a lot of paintings.
Yeah, Titian, Artemisia Gentileschi.
How is it thought of now? Is this a fondly regarded work of Ovid?
Up until relatively recently, it was not particularly highly thought of. There was a massive surge of interest, perhaps not surprisingly, around the turn of the millennium. Mm. So as the year 2000 approached, people suddenly became interested in the Roman calendar and Ovid's Fasti. And there's an enormous amount of interest in it still. It's a work that I think is very much read.
Can we have a word about translations then? What have you both got in front of you? What do you recommend people track down if they want to read the Fasti? Is there a good balance between poem and translation?
We're very fortunate, actually, in that we have two very, very good translations. We have one by A.J. Boyle and Roger Woodard, which is published in Penguin. That one is in verse, a really good introduction and very detailed notes. The other one is by Anne and Peter Wiseman. It's quite different in approach. It's in prose rather than verse. It's different also in that they take a different slant on the politics of Fasti. The Wisemans view the poem as patriotic, whereas Boyle and Woodard treat it as deliciously subversive.
Wow. That
is a quote. It's good to have different perspectives on this poem. Another, I think, really important difference is that the Boyle translation, which I like very much, also provides the calendar information as to what kind of day this was marked as on the Roman calendar. This is a practice that only came in the mid-1860s, whereas the Wisemans don't give that information and they just put the date down in the margin. And I have to say that that's a practice that I approve of.
Mm.
They're quite different, but I think that they are both valuable and both very useful. On balance, I guess if I have to choose, I would say I prefer the Boyle and Woodard, but I think they're both very valuable.
I think that the Boyle-Woodard translation sometimes takes us closer to particularly some of the unpleasant things that are going on in this text. I know that doesn't sound like a good way of selling it, but I think there has been a tendency to skate over some of the aspects of violence, especially sexual violence in Roman texts. Boyle and Woodard, they're not hands off with that. There are some really awful things happening. And I would say, actually, there's more explicit violence here even than the Metamorphoses at times. I think it's really important not to deny that, not to make it sound a bit more fairy tale-y than it is. It really isn't a nice set of fairy tales. People should be warned that there are some nasty stories in here, and Ovid is not skating over a lot of that, and I don't think a translation should either.
No, I agree entirely with that, and it is a serious problem, actually. I'm thinking particularly of Metamorphoses rather than Fasti, that skating over violence and pretending that rape is something other than it is pretty characteristic of a lot of translators.
Can I ask then, why do you think this is a good text to learn about?
I think it's interesting in quite a number of ways. One is, if you're interested in Ovid, and there is a lot of interest in Ovid, it's a fascinating poem to look at. It's also interesting if you're interested in Augustan politics, because I think it gives you a lot of insight into the way in which Augustus is manipulating language and visual images and stories as a way of justifying his regime. After all, remember, this is a guy who comes to power through civil war, the least legitimate means of achieving power. There's a massive change in branding, so he becomes no longer Gaius Julius Caesar Octavius or whatever, and becomes Augustus. Think of all those statues, the eternally beautiful Augustus. He looks like that from age 30 to age 70.
Mm.
There's a huge marketing exercise going on. And I think that, well, this I will reveal my hand, I think that you can see the Fasti is resisting that. It's interesting in many ways, actually.
There is a lot of engagement with Augustan monuments, you can see here.
Absolutely.
Are monuments sometimes directly referred to, or the
Temple of Mars Ultor is referred to, the name changed, adopting the name Augustus.
Mm.
There's a section on that. And then it's engaging with other aspects of Augustan culture, like the stories of the foundation of Rome, the nature of prophecy, this kind of prophecy you find in Virgil, where people have always said it was a fraud. That is to say, from the remote past, you predict the present. Well, Ovid kind of focuses on that and points out that, well, there's something a bit shonky about that.
I think it's fascinating, I guess, because I read the Metamorphoses a lot and teach it, that this is another longer work that technically is at least book by book, within each book joined together. And the Metamorphoses claims to be one continuous song. But this is sort of a different take on that and a much more Roman take, given that the Metamorphoses deals particularly for the first two thirds with Greek and some Near Eastern myths. And it's still a Roman work and a Roman take on those myths. But here we have more specifically Roman mythic history being drawn out.
So that's true. The Roman stuff only comes in very late into Metamorphoses. This gives him a chance to tell lots of Roman stories.
Mm.
That was Dr. Peter Davis, Visiting Research Fellow in Classics at the University of Adelaide, and Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. As always, they are very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us all on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. Peter is at Peter J. Davis 2. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.